Case for argument this morning is Higginbotham against Baxter International.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm here today on behalf of plaintiff's appellant in this class action against Baxter International and four of its most senior executives. Your Honors, there was an admitted fraud at Baxter, a fraud that led to the internal investigations and to the ultimate dismissal of two senior managers in Baxter Brazil and a vice president of finance as well. What was the fraud, Your Honors? Baxter Brazil recorded fictitious sales to fictitious customers.
The amount involved relative to what was $70 million. What is Baxter's annual revenue?
Your Honor, it admittedly the restatement at issue here.
I asked you a question.
I believe it's. I don't know the exact figure, Your Honor.
It's billions.
It is billions, Your Honor. Yes.
So how much did the stock market move when this revelation came out?
The stock market dropped, I believe, around 6%, Your Honor.
Baxter lost 6% because of a $70 million adjustment in revenue?
That's precisely the point, Your Honor. Is that
absolute or net? If you net out what happened to the rest of the stock market and the pharmaceutical industry on the day, what was Baxter's net?
I believe it's an absolute number, Your Honor.
Why? I mean, absolute numbers are uninteresting. It may just tell you that the stock market was down that day. How did Baxter move relative to the market? Did you apply the capital asset pricing model?
I believe, Your Honor, that the pharmaceutical indices that day actually rose while Baxter's share price dropped.
Well, I would suggest that it's even more than 5 or 6%. But my question is, did you apply the capital asset pricing model and determine the Baxter-specific residual?
I did not personally, Your Honor.
I mean your side of the litigation. There are lots of experts who are perfectly happy to do this. Did you, as in your side of the litigation, do it?
I don't believe we have, Your Honor. We have not actually gotten into the damages at issue in this case. I think the point is that although the restatement itself may have been de minimis, what we have here are statements made during the restatement that showed that Baxter had made statements that were false and misleading when they were made, that there are qualitative restatements that were said here, qualitative restatements along the lines that Baxter's internal controls that they had said were effective, were in fact not effective.
Why would the CEO of the company be lying about such a trivial matter?
Your Honor, I would say that the CEO, Parkinson, made his statements with Sienter. Either he made them intentionally or recklessly, Your Honor.
I mean, the alternative hypothesis is that they don't want to start throwing around accusations of fraud against the people in Brazil unless they, you know, complete their investigation. So why wouldn't that be more sensible, given it's so small, right? It can't hurt the fact that a foreign subsidiary has this, a monkey shines in a foreign subsidiary, leading to a minor, you know, exaggeration of earnings. Why would that lead a rational person, CEO of the huge company, to engage in all this dishonest activity that you accuse them of?
Two responses, Your Honor. First of all, again, the statements that plaintiffs complain about are not the actual revenue figures, the net earnings figures. They're complaining about the statements about Baxter's internal controls and disclosure controls. They're complaining about representations regarding drivers of sales growth and product penetration in Latin America. The cases that defendants at Pelley's have cited regarding the fact that the restatement was de minimis go to allegations of misstatements in financial data, and those are not the statements that we're complaining about here, Your Honor. Secondly, in response, I would say...
Why not? This is a this is a big puzzle to me. One would think that the complaint in this suit should be about the actual false statements which were made with Sienter. That is, the managers in Brazil knew the truth, and they were deliberately lying.
Well,
and
Your Honor,
those lies are included in the financial statements.
Your Honor, the
but
false
you say
statements...
you're not pursuing that. That was obvious from your brief, and I wonder why.
Well, the false statements were, and particularly with Defendant Parkinson, when he signed the Sarbanes-Oxley certification in the May 10, 2004, first quarter 10-Q, that he had designed disclosure controls and procedures or supervised their design, that he evaluated the effectiveness of such disclosure controls and procedures, that he evaluated the internal controls over financial reporting and disclosed all significant deficiencies, and that he disclosed any fraud, whether or not material. He made these statements recklessly, Your Honor.
But hadn't he been hired just the previous month?
That's exactly true, Your Honor. He had only been there.
So he didn't know what was going on, right?
Well, then he should have made the statements, Your Honor. He is not obliged to make the statements. Only after 14 days on the job, he is telling the public, the world, investors who are relying on his statements that disclosure controls and internal controls are effective. And, in fact, they weren't, as Baxter later admitted. After only 14 days on the job, he probably should not have made those statements. He wasn't obligated to. Sarbanes-Oxley Section 302 requires the principal executive officer, quote, or persons performing similar functions to sign that certification. Someone else could have signed, or he could have delayed the filing of the 10-Q to get his ducks in a row, to make sure the statements he was making were, in fact, accurate. The point is, he was there only 14 days. He had no prior employment with Baxter. He was in no position to make those statements, and he should not have made them. Your Honor, the certifications themselves support an inference of scienter. He is saying that he did those things. He evaluated the internal disclosure controls after only 14 days on the job. It's near impossible to perform such an evaluation, and the public is relying on statements that he did those
you
things.
You can see how you should be able to see. You're putting these people in a completely impossible position because here you're a new CEO, and you can't sign things because, after all, you've only been there for a few weeks. So then you send a terrible signal to the public. They say, why didn't the CEO sign this?
It wouldn't be a terrible signal, Your Honor. I've been here only 14 days. Someone else needs to sign so I can make sure the statements I'm going to make are true and that you can rely on them. That's the basis of our public reporting system.
Is that what's happening now? Every time a new CEO is appointed, there's some lag time when someone else is signing the Sarbanes-Oxley forms?
I don't know the answer to that question. I would hope so. I would hope that any
you
statement...
You would hope so.
I would hope
great.
That any,
that's what we need.
I would hope that any statement a company makes and a CEO makes is accurate when it's made. And there is... we have alleged a lot of facts, Your Honor, that show that they were not accurate. Your Honor, again, if he had done the investigation he said he did, he certainly would have uncovered...
You notice, by the way, that you didn't answer my question. My question was, why have you not alleged willful falsity in the original financial statements?
Again,
that's a place where one can show actual willfulness. There are demonstrable liars. So why not emphasize that?
Again, the restatements were de minimis in magnitude. They were quantitatively de minimis, but not qualitatively de minimis. They go to the heart of a reporting organization, is that their internal controls and their disclosure controls are, in fact, effective. And they were not, Your Honor. After,
but if it's, as you put it, quantitatively...
It's just a big puzzle. You've got a case where there is demonstrable lying. You choose not to sue about the demonstrable lies, but to sue about things that it's almost impossible to show scienter about and no one had any reason to lie about. It's almost as if you set out to find the one kind of suit that will be blocked by the PSLRA and bring that.
I don't believe that's true, Your Honor. Again, there were statements made, and those statements were false and misleading. They may not be actual figures, but the company has said, and the four defendants have said that disclosure controls, internal controls, were effective. And then, in a very short duration thereafter, within months, they said that they were not. Oops, we made a mistake. We said we looked at it. We said we looked at it carefully. And they were not effective. We're sorry. Well, the public has a right to rely on all their statements that they are, in fact, truthful and accurate. Your Honor, Parkinson himself had red flags. Prior to his joining, Baxter was publicly accused of bid rigging by the Brazilian government. This is information that was present at Baxter before his arrival, and we certainly alleged... Actually, the accusation of bid rigging was just 3 days before his arrival at Baxter, and we certainly have alleged he was a hands-on manager, a fact in of itself that case law shows supports an inference of scienter, and that he was Baxter's most senior executive officer, a fact that has weight in the totality of plaintiff's scienter allegations. Defendants cite cases in their brief that Sienter based exclusively or merely on a defendant's corporate position is not properly pled. Your Honor, we have alleged far more than just his corporate position. Your Honor, defendants will argue that the restatement had nothing to do with these frauds. The bid rigging and the kickbacks themselves were uncovered at the end, according to confidential witnesses, uncovered at the end of the first quarter of 2004 and brought to the attention of Baxter Management. This was a month before he actually started. Defendants will argue that the bid rigging and the kickbacks had nothing to do with the restatement, that the restatement itself, as Baxter said, quote, the restatement is primarily the result of incorrect revenue recognition. Well, Your Honor, we think that his knowledge of bid rigging and of kickbacks directly led to the restatement. The restatement is primarily the result of those things, not exclusively, and kickbacks and bid rigging certainly affect revenues and certainly fall under the rubric of revenue recognition. He had knowledge. He claims he did not know of the fictitious sales until the May timeframe. We allege that he knew much sooner than that. But the bid rigging and the kickbacks themselves he knew of, and those frauds themselves, which affected revenues, show that the disclosure and internal controls were not effective.
I don't understand you. You think internal controls are ineffective if they don't have 100% efficacy?
Your Honor, defendants have posited that exact point, that no controls cannot be 100% because they can be, and I'd like to use the words that they used, but you can get around them, essentially, is what they said. And I would posit, Your Honors, that actually the fact that they can so easily, you can so easily do an end run around those controls.
Well, how do we know it's so easily? I don't understand.
Because, Your Honor, look at what happened. They reported fictitious, they made up customers, they made up sales. Over 10% of Baxter Brazil's sales.
You don't think there are successful frauds that against companies that have good internal controls?
I'm not saying that, Your Honor, but in fact there was a case here I'm looking for. It's a District of Oregon case where they precisely held the In Re Lattice Semiconductor case where the CFO overrode the internal controls. In that case, the CFO prematurely recognized revenues, and the court said, quote, the fact that the controls were overridden, quote, this further underscores the contradiction between the facts and the Sarbanes-Oxley certifications. Here, we don't have premature revenue recognition. We have fictitious revenue recognition.
You're not answering. The question is, what is the standard for adequacy of internal controls? It can't be 100% detection of frauds.
No, Your Honor, I would admit that, but I would say, no matter what the standard is, this case fulfills whatever standard there is because the conduct is so egregious. Making up revenues. You have to understand that when they...
But Parkinson didn't make up revenues, right? Parkinson certifies that they have internal controls.
Yeah, but the fraud shows that the controls were not effective. And he made statements about the controls.
No, that's what you keep missing. You think that any fraud shows that the internal controls are ineffective.
Not any fraud, Your Honor. This fraud shows that the controls are ineffective. Making up revenues.
How does Parkinson in May know that the controls are ineffective?
Well, Your Honor, he said he investigated them. He looked into them thoroughly. And when the company actually did their restatement, they said that in their investigation of the problem in Brazil, they found that the controls were not effective. Those were their exact words.
Right? They do an investigation. Yeah.
They did an investigation, and they said, quote, there were ineffective control environment in Brazil, inadequate revenue recognition controls, ineffective financial review, inadequate controls regarding loss contingencies, including bad debt, and all of these factors together.
What is your best evidence that in May Parkinson knew or was recklessly indifferent to whether there were adequate internal controls?
The following, Your Honor. That, number one, he had red flags. Baxter was publicly accused prior to his arrival, a few days before his arrival, of engaging in fraud by the Brazilian government. Secondly, confidential witnesses that we've quoted in our brief have said that the kickbacks were reported up the chain and that he knew, and that was two senior managers, and that was just before he arrived at Baxter. Thirdly, we believe that, as I was explaining before, the certifications themselves give rise to an inference of scienter. Again, the company did an investigation of the fraud and found internal controls were not effective. Well, Parkinson said he had done an investigation. He certified that he did. If he had done that properly, he would have uncovered. If he had asked simple questions, he would have uncovered that there was a fraud. And he would never have made the certifications that he made that the class members relied on in making their investment decision. Your Honor, I'd like to move on, if I may,
to... You're creating quite a formula for securities class actions, which is any time some irregularity comes to light in a vast corporation, multi-billion-dollar corporation, you look at the CEO's Sarbanes-Oxley certification and say, oh, he should have realized that the company's internal controls are no good. Then you're off and running.
Well, Your Honor, the flip side of that is that certifications become boilerplate.
It's too ridiculous.
The flip side is certifications become boilerplate.
Ridiculous.
That the certifications just get put in, they get signed off on without any investigation whatsoever. That's unfair to me.
How can the CEO of a company be investigating every little tiny foreign subsidiary?
Well, Your Honor, certainly I wouldn't say...
When he's only been in office for a couple of weeks.
50% of Baxter's revenues come from its foreign
subsidiaries. Not from Brazil, not from this little...
No, not from Brazil, but certainly collectively they're
vital. Collectively, look, if you've got 1,000 different subsidiaries, collectively they're very big. That's a very big part of your company. But that doesn't mean that the CEO investigates every one of those 1,000 subsidiaries.
Your Honor, he didn't have to investigate. It was right there in front of him. Publicly accused of a fraud by the Brazilian government.
Look, a big company is being accused of fraud 10 times a day.
And I would think a CEO would know when his company is accused of fraud.
But a CEO can't investigate every... if some angry customer calls up IBM and says, you know, your accounts department is overcharging me, you know, something like that.
Actually, as I understand it, what they were accused of, or what they had been publicly accused of, was an antitrust violation, which means that they were accused of making too much money, not of overstating their profits.
Well,
it was only later that the fact that the profits had been overstated came to light. Am I mistaken about the sequence?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. They were accused of being participants in...
Why should an accusation that their profits were too high alert the CEO to the possibility that their profits actually were not as high as reported?
Well, they were accused of being a part of a cartel to boost their revenues.
Yes, a cartel means that they're charging prices that are too high and reaping monopoly profits. That's very different.
I think it's
completely different from an allegation that the profits have been fraudulently overstated.
The cartel's a little bit more complicated than that, Your Honor, and I don't know that I can explain it well here. It's that they, with other purveyors of blood products, got together and somehow rigged the bidding system so they could get business from the Brazilian government.
It's a cartel, yeah.
And they would have not gotten those revenues had they not been part of that cartel. And, Your Honor, we have defendant Anderson, who I believe my time is waning, but we have sales here, sales of Baxter stock that are highly suspicious both in timing and amount. Defendant Anderson sold 44,000 shares around the time confidential witnesses said he learned of the fraud, and he sold in April.
But hadn't he announced earlier an intention to sell?
He announced his intention to sell at around the time that we've alleged he learned of the fraud. Your Honor, can I reserve my remaining time for rebuttal?
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Paul. Mr. Kipp.
Good morning. I can answer some of the questions on the facts, Judge Posner, that you posited. In 2003, Baxter had sales of $9 billion. In 2003, Brazil had sales of $100 million. The math is 1.1%. The restatement is announced on August 6, 2004. Baxter restated 2001 through 2003. Collectively, on revenue side, it is less than 0.2% of reported revenues. If you want the quick math, Baxter reported 24.3%.
Did you run a study under the capital asset pricing model to find out what the market, what the movement of Baxter's price was net of the market?
The answer is yes and no. Yes, we did because we were retained, but no, not in our motion to dismiss did we discuss it.
We did, but it's not in the record.
That's correct. I can give you these facts, Judge. The price on July 22nd falls by 4.58%. On July 22nd, a lot more is disclosed other than a minor restatement. They also discuss a restructuring charge involving 4,000 employees and also the fact that they're going to take a charge, a current period charge, to income. And so there's a lot going on in the July 22nd, 2004 press release. And importantly there, the July 22nd press release says, we're going to restate. Here's the general scope. I think that's where you got your $70 million in revenue. Mm-hmm. But the company says, we're not quite done yet. We're still finalizing these numbers. And then when it files its 10-K-A 2 weeks later on August 6th, revenues get restated by $37 million. Earnings get restated by $33 million for that three-year period. Interestingly, for the first quarter of 2004, revenues aren't restated at all, and earnings are restated by $2 million, which is 1.1%. But what that means is that there's no way that Mr. Parkinson, who joins on April 26th, can see any unusual spike in revenues for that quarter because revenues aren't changed. They're accurately reported for that quarter. What's central to our analysis is a conference call that Mr. Parkinson has on July 22nd, the day of the announcement, and on which plaintiffs rely. They not only allege it, they rely on it, in which he says that we only became aware of some problem in Brazil in the May time frame, and then, frankly, we only got our arms around it in the last week or two. And we also know that that investigation is obviously continuing because Baxter wasn't able to quantify the magnitude until August 6th. And so the notion that Mr. Parkinson is aware of problems in Brazil before that time is refuted by this affirmative allegation that plaintiffs themselves make in their complaint about what Mr. Parkinson knew and when he knew it. And Judge Posner, you're right. Mr. Parkinson, when he first got the email, he orders an investigation, first internally. He has internal audit look into it. And then externally, they bring in outside counsel and outside auditors, and then they determine sometime in late July what the problem is, and they disclose it, first in the July 22nd press release and then later in the 10-K-A. The reliance by plaintiffs on confidential witnesses simply doesn't meet the standard articulated in the May Core Issues versus Tell Labs case as far as the reliability of such witnesses. You have to know the source of the information. You have to know how they acquired it. You need to be able to confirm that they're not relying on third-hand information or second as opposed to first. None of that you will find in the complaint.
I'm puzzled by this concept, the confidential witness. What are they? They're like police informants?
I wish I knew. We don't know because
they haven't been identified to the judge or anything?
No, they have not. And we're here on a motion to dismiss. They have not. They're anonymous. We don't know the specific positions they held. We don't know the specific information to which they had access. And we certainly don't know the specific individuals to whom they spoke. None of that is in the second amended complaint. A word about both the Brazil, the quote-unquote red flags, which, to quote the old saw, we view more as red herrings. It's if you look at the cartel, it involves a period from 1998 to 2002. That's alleged in the complaint. And so we simply don't know when Mr. Parkinson came on board what he knew about this cartel. We don't know what the amounts involved, if any are, whether Baxter ultimately was found liable or not. We don't know anything about it. With respect to the quote-unquote kickback scheme, you won't see that phrase in the second amended complaint. Rather, if you look at paragraphs 55 through 59 of the complaint, you'll see allegations relating to rebate arrangements. And those allegations suggest that Baxter managers in Brazil, trying to enhance their own bonuses, went and leaned on vendors and said, you have to kick in a little more money. You know, perhaps the company booked it to revenues. Perhaps they reduced cost of sales. Either way, sure, it might have an effect on Baxter-wide revenues. But once we get to the briefs, we see some evolving facts. And now all of a sudden it's a scheme. It involves people trying to line their own pockets. You won't see that in the second amended complaint. Those allegations simply do not exist. And with respect to your other point, Judge Posner, about the almost untenable situation new CEOs find themselves in, well, with Mr. Parkinson joins on April 26th. Obviously, he has a certification to execute in 2 weeks, and he's dealing with a $9 billion company, and we certainly know that no other shoes dropped after this July 22nd announcement. And so his efforts to gain that reasonable assurance that internal controls were, in fact, adequate certainly worked, and there's no allegation in the complaint that suggests that during those 14 days he otherwise was remiss in not doing what he needed to gain the requisite comfort that Baxter's internal controls were, in fact, adequate. And obviously our position is, though, those Sarbanes-Oxley certifications are correct on their face.
How did the confidential witnesses come into the case? I mean, presumably the complaint is just tested by its allegations, not by its evidentiary foundations. Isn't that right?
Well, you're right, but because a recent strain in securities cases is the appearance of these confidential witnesses, and so there's now a line of cases that discusses when viewing the adequacy of these allegations under the Reform Act's requirements, what needs to be alleged in order to provide that strong inference of scienter that the Reform Act demands. And in this,
I understand. Do you have to mention that your allegations are based on confidential witnesses, or
no.
Can you just?
You don't have to, but if you do, if you are relying on a confidential witness to bolster or support an allegation you're making, Judge Easterbrook, it's almost like the DeLeo standard, not quite, but you need the who, what, when, where, and how. And so,
DeLeo didn't have anything to do with the PSLRA.
Oh, you're absolutely right, and I don't mean to suggest it does. DeLeo predates the PSLRA. But as far as what this court says in Macor Rights or what the Second Circuit has said in Novak, the plaintiff is duty-bound if the plaintiff is to meet this heightened scienter requirement to provide sufficient information in order to show that these allegations from these confidential witnesses is reliable. And what that reduces to,
I gather from reading Macor Rights that the propriety of keeping the identity of witnesses confidential at this stage was not contested in Macor Rights.
That doesn't
seem to be contested here either.
Well, we don't contest the propriety. We contest the adequacy of what they say.
One could say, it seems to me still open, to say that the PSLRA standard cannot be met with things imputed to unidentified people.
I would welcome such a statement, and yes, I agree. But putting aside
you're not making any such argument.
We're not making such argument, Your Honor.
Nor was such an argument made in Macor Rights. It was a puzzle to me that it wasn't made, but here we are.
Well, here we are, and you're right on both counts. We didn't make that argument per se, but what we did argue, as you well know, is that the information from these confidential witnesses doesn't meet the standard as articulated in the Reform Act. Otherwise, our arguments are set forth in our briefs. I'm happy to answer any additional questions. Otherwise, we'll rest on our brief.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Paul?
Yes,
Your Honor, I just want to correct a misimpression that was made.
I'm happy with the confidential witnesses.
I'm happy with them.
Where does that come from? I don't understand. How can you have a confidential witness? Someone whose life is threatened?
No, confidential witness is someone who worked for the company, who had inside information, who knew. We've alleged five confidential witnesses. We stated when they worked at the company,
right.
How they worked at the company.
Well, why not their names?
And what they because they want to be kept confidential, because there's fear of reprisal in the industry for future jobs.
I don't understand you.
Look, pursue the case until they're revealed.
I don't understand you. I don't understand.
You're allowed to have unnamed witnesses.
I've never seen a civil case. Sometimes, you know, we'll use a different, you know, we'll use a John Doe or something for a litigant because very embarrassing. We actually frown on that, but occasionally we'll do that. But I've never heard of a case where you have a civil case where you have unidentified witnesses.
Your Honor, I believe that
These people going to testify behind a screen? With a voice alteration?
No, Your Honor, they won't testify. They're used to support the allegations in the complaint, and we.
What? They're not going to testify. What? I don't understand you. You put allegations in a complaint that you can't substantiate because they're supplied by people you're not going to call as witnesses?
No, Your Honor. We'll get witnesses who will testify who don't need to preserve their anonymity, and we'll gain information through discovery.
I'm baffled.
I would love to explain it further, Your Honor, but I think my time is up.
Why did you mention them in the complaint?
Absolutely, in the complaint, in the briefs.
Why?
Because we based some of our allegations.
But look, obviously, having a confidential witness doesn't strengthen an allegation.
I believe it does, Your Honor. When you say, and you have to say. That the probability.
But it could be any kind of snitch, any kind of liar,
Your Honor, we have to describe
anonymous accusations against a company, and that you regard as.
Your Honor, it's further support.
Well, I would think a complaint based on that would flunk the requirement that a complaint is supposed to be based on a reasonable inquiry.
Well, certainly it's not based exclusively.
When someone calls you up, disguises his voice, and says, oh, monkey business going on in the Brazilian subsidiary, that you regard as sufficient to file a complaint?
Your Honor, we know who they are, but we've protected their anonymity. We have said where they worked, when they worked, and what their positions were. And as long as we've alleged that they occupied a position to know what we've alleged they know.
Well, can't your opponent test that? I mean, suppose the opponent says this complaint was filed without an investigation on the part of the plaintiff, and it's just based on these confidential witnesses who we think are probably just liars. So wouldn't you have to reveal the identity so that the plaintiff could...
Your Honor, we'd be happy to reveal their names to you in camera so that
no,
they...
No, to the opponent so they can test
again,
the adequacy of your pre-complaint investigation.
Again, I think the law wants these people to be able to come forward and still protect their anonymity at the same time so there's not fear of reprisal.
Look, we don't permit... We don't have laws. We don't have anonymous lawsuits.
It's certainly not anonymous, Your Honor. We've alleged exactly when they worked, where they worked. I'm sure the defendants can figure out exactly who they are. We've alleged enough information about them, just not their names. They would not have spoken to us if they had given us their names. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Mr. Paul. The case is taken under advisement.